ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. This is a continuation of a series, but each of these lectures is more or less independent, though it's part of a continuing series, The Evolution of Advaita. So, as you know, Advaita is considered to be the peak of India's philosophical evolution. I mean, a system of philosophy which is transcendental, which is universal, and which is relevant for all people in all traditions, in all religious faith systems, and even to agnostics. This is considered to be the only religious philosophy which can accommodate people who are not necessarily religious. So frequently this is misunderstood, maybe misinterpreted as some kind of a theological system. That's because Advaita is a system which reconciles, which harmonizes both theology and philosophy. You know, philosophy is an independent search for truth, and theology relies so much on faith and revelations and what may be called divine interventions, ideas and concepts and teachings found in scriptures which are non-negotiable, which you are expected to completely accept and believe in. That is theology. But Advaita reconciles all these three. I shall try to explain. That is something very important. Those of you, of course, it's an academic subject, but it is a very fascinating study. Those of you who are interested, you'll find great thinkers who don't have any Hindu background or Indian background, and some of them belonging to different cultures which are not expected to share many of the common beliefs of Oriental societies. When they read about Advaita, they found that it is actually their own story. Some of the most profound doctoral theses on Advaita Vedanta were written by scholars outside India. Hajime Nakamura, I mean the two volumes, you know. They're all about the evolution of early history of Advaita. Quotations from hundreds of scriptures. A scholar who spent decades, long after he had presented his PhD thesis, he worked on the thesis, perfected the book, and the result is what could be called the most extensive, the most encyclopedic exposition of Advaita Vedanta, with Japanese scholar. And if you look at the evolution of Advaita, this Advaita philosophy began to be well known outside Indian subcontinent only from the later half of 18th century. That is the beginning of the influence of Advaita, the later half of 18th century. Many German Indologists, who were later followed by Indologists from Britain and from France and from other countries, they also continued this trend. So, you know, the conflict area is between faith and independent search for truth. Independent search for the truth is the essence of philosophy. Faith is the cornerstone of theology. Now, The one important slogan the Shankaracharya repeats throughout his books, in Sanskrit it's called Sutya Yuktya Swanubhutya. What it means is, you read a book, it could be the Vedas, but the Bible, it could be Torah, Talmud, or Tripitakas of the Buddhist, anything you read, the great teachings, the revelations, the experiences of the ancient teachers and saints, you read, or you may listen to. And then, well, you don't blindly believe in. Now, this is coming from Shankaracharya, the original exponent of Advaita, who, for the first time, gave a meaning to Vedic mantras in 8th century, and who actually perfected Advaita as a compact philosophical system, a metaphysical system, gave it an epistemology, an ontology, and a clear-cut definitions of ontology, and also the fundamental principles of interpretation is hermeneutics. So first he says, read a book. But when you read the book, you need not blindly believe in. I don't think any other great thinker, a philosopher, has so boldly declared. And he's a religious teacher. He's the greatest system builder in Indian tradition. All the monastic orders, if you go to India, including ours, or if you go to Chinmay Mission, if you go to any of these Hindu Swamis wandering anywhere in the world, they all are linked to Shankaracharya's monastic order, 10 monastic orders. When compared to the Jesuit order by Ignatius Loyola, or the Franciscan order of St. Francis of Assisi, 10 monastic orders. So he says, read a book, that is fine. Now remember, this is not exclusive to Advaita. In fact, there will be many great mystics in all traditions who did not stop with reading, who did not stop with belief, who actually tried to practice using their own reasoning power. And in the process, sometimes they disobeyed the hierarchy. So without disobeying the hierarchy, no one could advance from belief to reason. The great mystics did that, and there is experience, but that was always at the cost of their affinity, their affiliation to the hierarchy that they belong to. So first, you'll read the book. Secondly, yuktya. Yukti means logic, reasoning power. Your own ability to rationalize, to analyze, and to reach independently at your own conclusions. So he says, use your reasoning power. And then, experience. Svanubhutya, one's own inner experience. Now, these are three fundamental principles of Advaitic evolution. Read or listen, but believe only to verify later using your own reasoning power, and then you cannot stop the experience. Svanibhutya. Now, this is the cornerstone of Advaita. Now, this Advaita system also is deeply humanistic. In fact, that's what we are coming to today. How can a very idealistic system of philosophy also be very humanistic? With the humanism, Advaita system would have become just an academic subject, a philosophical construct. So that is an important point, remember. It is not a philosophical construct. For example, you can verify, you go to Stanford or Harvard, anywhere, you can discuss with any professor teaching Kant, for Immanuel Kant. Kantians, they call it, anglicized pronunciation. Kant. Those who believe, those who teach critical pure reason, critical practical reason. Kant was the one who questioned the empiricists and the other utilitarians who preceded him. Now, and they are called Kantians. But it is a subject that you discuss in a classroom, an intellectual gathering. You may appreciate as a great idea. That is fine. But Advaita is not just a great idea that you discuss in the living room or a classroom. It is something that you practice from the time you wake up in the morning till you go to sleep. I shall give an example. It's a very important thing, you know. If you read Vedas, the Samhita portions, the ritualistic portions, you come across so many deities, you know, Indra, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, Dhyava, Prithivi, Soma, and so on. Number of Vedic deities, Vedic concepts of gods and goddesses, you find in the Rigveda Samhita, the ancient, I mean, going 4th millennium BC. Now, today you don't find, if you go to India, you don't find people worshipping all this. You don't find. But you find them in the 6th century AD, 5th century AD, 4th century AD. In the Gaudapada Karika, there are a number of such deities and their followers referred to by Gaudapada. Now, what Shankara did, you know, and before that I would tell you, if you go to a traditional Hindu family in India, maybe he's a professor teaching Advaita Vedanta in a university, or maybe a self-proclaimed Advaiti, a non-dualist. So you may imagine, oh, because non-dualism tells you that God is not limited to a temple. You need not necessarily go to a temple and worship God to be an Advaiti. That's what Advaita teaches you. Advaita focuses on a God idea that is transcendental, that is omnipresent, and also that is that transcends the limitations of names and forms. It doesn't, that Advaita God doesn't have a name. Brahman is not the name of Advaiti God. Brahman itself means Brihatvat. Brihatvat means it's, if you believe in, it is the all-pervading reality that we experience. That's what we call Brahman is called. So, okay, now this coming subject. If you go to a typical Hindu home in India, who may be an Advaiti, you find in a shrine, there he'll be fine. Morning he gets up and he performs all these rituals. He worships the 5 deities. You may think, how can it be? How can it be an Advaiti philosopher also go to a temple and engage in worship? How can it be? How can a professor also go to kindergarten in the morning? He cannot do that. People believe that. And that's why, that's the genius of Advaita. So Shankaracharya says, there's a ways, you know, Adityambigam Vishnum Gananatham Maheswaram Panja Yajnaparo Nityam Grihastha Panja Pujaya. He says, you may believe in Advaita philosophy, but your mind may not have reached there. So in order to condition your mind, you should perform certain rituals. If you are in that level of consciousness all the time, you don't have to. But other times, otherwise, when you are staying in your home, an ordinary householder who is always in a state of samadhi, he should get up in the morning, he should perform puja. So this puja is sometimes puja of Divine Mother, puja of God Surya, this Ganesha, you find Ganesha deities in Hindu temples in the Bay Area, you find. And then Shiva and Vishnu. So this Panchadevata Puja. So it's interesting, what he did, you know, he organized the Vedic pantheon, the deities, and organized them into 5 concepts of the divine to be worshipped by every householder in his home. Suppose, and of course, you know, this is a specific rules he prescribed to householders. That's an important thing. Not that there is any distinction, but he says householders may have this risk, they may face this problem. I believe in Advaita, so I won't care for anything. It's not like that. So every higher philosophical idea will have a very empirical equivalent. Means at the practical level, you should meditate, you should perform rituals, you should do all this, but with the full conviction that all these are different manifestations of the same divine spirit. So you can see the highest idealism and the highest realism. The problem with Buddhism, and it's happened in Indian tradition, you know, Buddhist philosophy had two developments in the later part of the evolution of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist thoughts. At the beginning of Buddhism, Buddha mostly preached in Prakrit, and his teachings were later on codified into three systems, three books known as Tripitakas. And the script that they used for writing Buddha's teachings was called Pali. So today, these great Buddhist teachers who come to America, you know, many Sri Lanka and other places especially, they mostly depend upon their Pali canonical literature, the Tripitakas, Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka, of which in fact the mindfulness, as I mentioned earlier many occasions, Mahasatyuppattana Sutta, which actually Digha Nikaya, Satyuppattana Sutta, which is Pali text, which is the foundation of mindfulness. It is in Pali language. Of course, it has a Sanskrit equivalent also, Smriti Upasthana Sutra in Sanskrit. But the original text was in Pali. It comes in Digha Nikaya, one of the Tripitakas. So Buddha was mostly concerned with the practical side of human life. How to control your mind, how to practice this, you know, the right conduct, the right behavior, the right speech, you know, Sammik Smriti, Sammik Ajiva, Sammik Vyayama, Sammik Walk, Sammik Samadhi. You can find the eight disciplines of Buddha, which will help take you to Nirvana. Now, the same Buddhism in India developed two schools of philosophy. One of them was an extreme kind of idealism, more like subjective idealism, much more profound. And because it is close to religious traditions, it had a deep implications on human culture than Berkeley's, you know, appearance of reality, you know, Berkeley's subjective idealism. But it's frequently compared to each other. So it was called Vijnanavada or Yogacara system of philosophy. Its later development completely denied both the external world and also the vijnana, the human mind. So it led to some kind of anarchy. So people did not get anything to eat. They got only dry bones. That will be like that, you know. And you people cannot live on dry bones of just some philosophical constructs. Remember, religion and culture and spirituality, they live in human minds only in the form of rituals, only in the form of some kind of congregational practices. This is an important thing to remember. Religions cannot exist as a philosophical construct. It would be a terrible misunderstanding if you ever believe that religion as a pure doctrine can exist anywhere. Cannot. Religion always needs some practical dimension. It may be in the form of a congregational gathering. It may be in the form of some kind of collective rituals, meditation practices, and so on. So, what happened, you know, Buddhism in India, unlike outside India, but within India, Buddhism was misunderstood, misrepresented as some kind of a dry idealism, especially with the emergence of this Yogacara system, the subjective idealistic trends in later Buddhist thought systems. At that time, Shankaracharya came. So he discovered one thing. You may present a very high philosophy before a society, but in reality, the society may not be actually practically benefited by that. It's not because the system is wrong, because the society, the common people and their minds always need something to practice, something physical, something they can connect with, they can touch physically. For that, rituals are necessary. So Shankaracharya said, you know, the highest Advaita philosophy, at the same time, every day you should perform certain rituals in your home. You can bring flowers from the garden. You can decorate the images. And you can bring fruits, sweets. And some of the Hindu temples you find, the amount of food they offer, how can God eat so much? And there's a funny video which I don't normally watch those things, but accidentally I happened to see when I was traveling. You know, one of the maybe British Prime Minister, David Cameron, was visiting one of the Swaminarayan temples in London. And he was respectfully received, garlanded with this sandal paste, and he was being led through these huge piles of laddus and jalebis, all my like him, mountains of gold, golden colored, brilliant, so absolutely wonderful to look at it. I don't know how wonderful it would be to eat for somebody suffering from diabetes. But the point is, that's a kind of food that Hindus offer to God. Now, after seeing this, when you listen to me, I'm talking about Advaita, which defines God as some kind of an all-pervading divine reality. How do you reconcile this? Deities eating so much, and at the same time, the concept of an idea, concept of a God, an idea of God, which is transcendental, which is all-pervading divine spirit. That's why Shankaracharya says, you may believe in this universal, global aspect of Advaita, one divine reality that is present everywhere, which has a deep, universal and humanistic aspect, because it helps you to look at your neighbor, to look at everyone around you with a compassion, understanding and kindness. That's something very interesting. So, Advaita on the one hand is an elevated philosophical construct. On the other hand, it is also deep humanism. If you look at Indian history, there is something that is fascinating and that attracts people all over the world in spite of so many other misrepresentations going on. You know, and Vivekananda refers to that in Chicago address. One reason why 4,500 people stood up and clapped their hands when Vivekananda spoke in 1893. You know, one important reason, you have to understand this. It has a deep connection with what we are discussing today. When Swamiji came in 1893, Swamiji's, if you look at the lectures that were delivered in the Parliament of Religion, and Dr. Barrows edited two volumes in the Proceedings of the Parliament of World Religions, 1893, two huge volumes. Some of the lectures are absolutely astounding. Different representatives of different religious traditions, Buddhism, and different denominations of Christianity. Of course, Buddhism, Sufism, and so on. Swamiji's lecture was perhaps the shortest. Less than 2 pages, may have lasted around 8, maybe less than 8 minutes, maybe 6 minutes. Swamiji's first Chicago address was 6 minutes. And other lectures, the great divines, the great scholarly divines of different denominations, they started their my sisters and brothers and my own heartiest elements in Jesus. They were highly endearing terms with which the great scholars addressed the audience. They certainly must have appreciated them. But it was something funny and humorous and interesting and quite fascinating. One, an unknown man wearing strange clothes, speaking with a different accent, obviously a stranger, to Western customs, speaking for 6 minutes, and becomes a celebrity overnight, to the point that on the later sessions, Vivekananda's name had to be announced to prevent people from leaving their rooms. And I should also commend the American society of those times, you know. American society of those times, the last decade of the 19th century, they had already become familiar with, at least many of them, with the transcendentalists, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, Madame Blavatsky, and many other great scholars who have introduced Eastern mysticism to American society. There was always an appreciation of the deep, of the profound, of the sublime, more than what you find today in 21st century. This is an important thing to remember. So we should also pay tribute to the American society of the last decade of 19th century. Okay, the subject is, Swamiji refers to something very interesting in Indian history. He says, he refers to the first diaspora of Jewish refugees who came to India in the 4th century BC and also in 70 AD, the last time the Masada collapsed in 70-71 AD, who came to India, and how Indian kings and people opened their gates, handed over the villages and gave them temples. Even recently, not long ago, Indian Prime Minister went to Israel, and he presented the Israeli Prime Minister the replica of the first copper inscriptions which indicate the handing over of these villages and temples to Jewish refugees who came to India in 70 AD. And then again, within maybe 40, 50 years, the first Christian missionaries also came to India, supposedly under St. Thomas. And then in 8th century, the Zoroastrians came, and Iran, Persia was overrun by Islamic invaders. Zoroastrian religion collapsed and they ran away for their life. They came to India. And what Indian kings did? They handed over the temples and villages. Not because they knew anything about these alien religious traditions, but because, well, these people also have their own system. They're also worshipping the same God whom we are worshipping as Shiva, Vishnu, Ganapati, who are maybe in our temples. The same God they're worshipping using different names, following different rituals in different ways. So that idea of looking upon entire humanity as one spiritual family, the idea that no religion in this world can be wrong, it can only be different, cannot be wrong. It may be different from my religion, but for that reason, it need not be wrong, it's never wrong. That idea is a direct consequence of the influence of Advaita on Indian culture. So that is what I'm talking about, the deep humanism of Advaita. So Advaita's deep humanism, that's why, you know, later he also, Shankaracharya, established this six schools of philosophy: Shaivam cha Vaishnavam Shaktam, Sauram Vainayagam Tatha, Skantam cha Bhakti Margasya, Darshanani Tathaiva cha. So, Shaivam cha Vaishnavam Shaktam, Sauram Vainayagam Tatha, Skantam cha Bhakti Margasya, Darshanani Tathaiva cha. I mean, Shaiva means the worship philosophical systems of Shiva, different Purana, different scriptures related to Shiva worship. Then Vishnu, Vaishnava means different scriptures related to Vishnu, Bhagavata Purana and so on. Then Shakta, you know, different scriptures related to Tantra tradition, divine matter. And then Subramanya, I mean Kumara, Skandam. And Vainayaga means the concept of Ganapati, Ganesha, etc. Now, the point is, these are different ways taking us to the same goal. So this idea of the oneness and unity of goal and plurality and diversity of paths, roads leading to that goal. So on the one hand, the goal is one. On the other hand, but the roads taking you to that road, that the goal could be different, could be diverse. So unity and oneness of goal and plurality and diversity of paths or ways to reach that goal. These are some of the unique aspects of Advaita humanism. It's a very, very interesting aspect of Advaita. In fact, this is the later evolution of Advaita. This humanistic aspect of Advaita was more strongly, more powerfully focused by the latest great champion of Advaita, that is Swami Vivekananda. Of course, remember, even after Swami Vivekananda, we had many, many great teachers of Advaita who appeared in America, in Europe, and also in India. From India, for example, the monastic orders of Chinmaya Mission. They're focusing the same path. Vivekananda still followed Vivekananda's path. In fact, in my own personal life, I tell you, as a student in studying the primary school, the first time that I listened to a talk on Swami Vivekananda was from Swami Chinmayananda. He's the founder of Chinmaya Mission. And he was talking about Swami Vivekananda, with the greatest exponent of Advaita after Shankaracharya in 8th century AD. So the point is, the deep humanism, the universality, the idea that if you are different from me, that doesn't mean that you are wrong, but that only means you, your path, your approach, your interpretation, the language that you use may be different from mine, but that doesn't mean that you are wrong, that I alone am right. That's not what I mean. I shall refer to something very interesting in this context. See, for example, how this idea was traditionally interpreted into scriptures. Well, Hindu Vedanti scriptures have got four great statements, which I'm not going to discuss in detail right now. I'm only going to focus on one, which is the closest of the four statements that comes closest to Advaita humanism. Advaita humanism, because all the four statements are equally important when you expound Advaita philosophy, but Advaita humanism is very so powerfully explained in this Mahavakya. Tattvamasi means what you are looking for, the truth that you are looking for, that is you yourself, within you, not your body mind complex, but beyond and behind all this, within you, the same spirit, the same soul. And that Atman is one with the entire universe. That Atman is all-pervading. That Atman is present in everyone. That Atman is the only absolute reality, the Satyam. Now, I mentioned the deep humanism of Advaita in the context of Swami Vivekananda's lectures, because today you find there are many conflicts in the name of religions. One of the main, of course, everyone knows about it, but in today's complex world, we don't discuss it so openly because it's very sensitive. But the point is, this Advaita humanism is the only permanent solution to all problems. In the Christian mystical tradition, the great mystics, beginning with Christ, with all the great mystics, have experienced this Advaita humanism, but the language they use must be different. Of course, when it comes to Meister Eckhart, the language is almost identical with that of Shankaracharya. If you read Eckhart, as interpreted by Rudolf Otto, he is almost like a repetition of the many of the statements that appear in Shankaracharya's commentaries, written in Sanskrit, 450 years before Eckhart. It's a different subject with the 13th century German theologian and philosopher. Apparently the greatest mystic apparently the greatest Christian mystic, who spoke and felt and experienced precisely what Shankaracharya had experienced 450 years before he was born. Now, coming to the subject, in the sixth chapter of Chandogya Upanishad, which is from Samaveda, there's an interesting story. A little boy who was sent away to study in a Vedic school by his father returns home, and the father wants to find out how far he has studied, and the father finds out that the child, not a child any longer actually, he had studied for 12 years, but he had become very haughty and proud. And then the father asks him, did you study that by studying which everything becomes known? So those who are interested, I can refer to Chandogya Upanishad, 6th chapter, 3rd mantra, you know, you find Saha dvadasa varsha upetya chaturvimshati varshaka sarvan vedan adhitya mahamana anuchanamani stabdha eyaya tamkha pita uvacha. This is how it begins. I won't inflict all these Sanskrit statements on you right now. But the point is, the boy returns. He's not longer a boy. He's a young man by then. His name is Swetaketu. Father's name is Uddalaka. He returns home and father asks him, how do you find? And the young man is very proud and haughty. So the father wanted to make him understand the importance of knowing the higher values by which you can become more broad-minded, you can become more humanistic. So the question he is asking is, yatha somya ekena mrutpindena sarvam mrmayam vijnatam syat vacharambhanam vikaro namadeyam mrutigeteva satyam yatha somya ekena lokamanina sarvam lokamayam vijnatam syat vacharambhanam vikaro namadeyam mrutigeteva satyam. Like that, lokamiteva satyam. He continues. Anyway, I'm not going to that. The point is, the father asked the child, the young man, have you studied that by studying which everything becomes known? What is that by learning, by knowing which everything else becomes known? Nothing empirical. So what is that supreme wisdom? The young man said, my teachers didn't teach any of those things. Then the father begins to instruct him. And the instruction given is only one statement. Tattvamasi. Tattvamasi. Literally means you are that. That you are. That's all. Now it may not sound anything. So it sounds much when you just hear. Meaning is, what you are looking everywhere, wherever you are looking for the higher spiritual truth, that truth is not found outside of you. It is found within you. It is you yourself. But not this physical body, the body-mind complex of yours, but the essence, the inner being of yours. Within you, that supreme reality, the Atman, that's the only supreme truth, that is you yourself. Once you realize this, you find the same Atman is all pervading, the same Atman is found everywhere. All others are also non-distinct and non-different from the same Atman. This teaching is given by the father to the son. For the first time, the teaching is given in the 9th section of the chapter that the student doesn't understand. Then the father repeats that instruction. So 8 repetitions, one statement, one instruction, and 8 repetitions of the same instruction. As the father expounds this idea, with fresh illustrations and examples, the student actually realizes this. Because every instruction helps the student to go deeper into the meaning of what he's listening to, and eventually he realizes what he listens to, and he realizes that he himself, the real he, the real Shvetaketu, is not a physical body, it is the Atman within, and that Atman is universal, it is present in everyone, everything. So this universal humanism, this idea of identifying oneself with the entire existence, cosmic existence, this is an important contribution of Advaita to world philosophical thoughts. Vivekananda, in his lectures, in Practical Vedanta lectures, he makes one important point. One should understand this, maybe I believe it should be taught everywhere. He says, the infinite oneness of the soul is the eternal sanction of all morality, all ethics, all good actions. The infinite oneness of the soul. That means the idea that spiritually existence is one, creation is one, humanity is one. This idea, in fact, it is the eternal sanction, is the ultimate foundational principle of all ethical and moral ideas. And Vivekananda goes on explaining this further. So if a person can be smarter, cleverer, more intelligent, and slightly more crooked than another person, why can't he rob his neighbor? Why should he depend upon some principle? Suppose you do away with all law enforcement system, judiciary and executive, the entire government system, and you live, then if a man is smarter, cleverer, stronger, and more evil, why can't he dominate over others? Many people tried that, actually, in different ways. If you look at history, you find it. Then, of course, there are many reasons you can put forward to say that it's wrong. But Vivekananda says the most acceptable reason, the most, I would say, the most logical reason why you should not do anything harmful to others. To do harm to others is not different from doing harm to yourself. This finally rests upon one principle. Spiritually, humanity is one. If you do harm to another person, you are doing harm to yourself, because you and other are not different, not distinct. You are non-distinct. So you cannot hurt another person. You cannot do harm to another person without actually hurting yourself, without actually harming yourself. Because you cannot hurt your right hand. With your left hand, you take a stick and hit your right hand, you only will feel the pain. So by doing harm to another person, we are doing harm to ourselves. Because there is no otherness. The other is only an imagination. There is only one reality. So Swami Vivekananda says, this is the most solid and the most logical and is the only eternal, no one can deny this, foundation of ethics and morality. So you can find the deep humanism of Advaita. So that's why Shankaracharya in his commentary says, you know, Advaita has no quarrel with anyone because it is non-distinct and non-different from all others. It is the same as others. It promotes this idea of universal human morality and ethics. So, apart from being a very profound philosophical system, Advaita is also a deep humanism. Humanism in its most universal sense. Because if you look at the evolution of humanism, it's another subject, of course, we had no time to deal with. Humanism itself had to go through different levels of evolution. And in the process, you find It begins with Plato. Plato also in his Republic talks about humanism. And he refers to humanism of the old Greek city-states, where only citizens were considered to be equal. And so humanism should be confined to people who are equal. There were others who were not considered to be equal. Even there is also, they are also in the evolution of humanism in Roman Empire also had their own humanism, but humanism only among Roman citizens. The vast majority of people were not free. They were serfs or slaves. They were prisoners. So there was no humanism extended beyond the Roman citizens, who enjoyed, of course, some kind of democratic humanism. Then also there was Catholic humanism, where, you know, humanistic impulse was limited to the people who believed, who shared the same hierarchical belief systems. This continued, you know. There were humanism, even utopian socialism, Robert Owen and others in the 19th century, in 1830s, humanism, Sigmund Freud and others also evolved their own humanism. But Advaita humanism is something different. Advaita humanism, it accommodates the entire humanity and even extends the entire creation. There are Vedic mantras which tell you that polluting the air, polluting the water, polluting the mountains and skies and oceans is as evil as doing harm to your own fraternity. The meaning, they used in Bhratara, it means your own brothers. So if you pollute waters, you'd be actually doing harm to your own family, because the entire creation is one spiritual family. It is not pantheism. Rather, it is the idea that existence is one. In fact, that's a central message of this particular Mahavakya, great statement called Tattvamasi, which I referred to. This is a unique contribution of Advaita to humanism as a philosophical school. So thank you. I have tried to give a brief outline of some aspects of Advaitic philosophy as interpreted later on during the post-Shankarite times, especially some of the modern Advaitic philosophers, beginning with Swami Vivekananda, going through Dr. Radhakrishnan and others. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.